Chapter 4. The Rich Get Richer and the Poor Get Poorer. Before I get to some astounding facts about the famed top 1% or 0.01%, here's a new one for you. A recent analysis of the relationships between 43,000 transnational corporations has identified a super entity of 147 closely knit firms whose ownership was all held by others within the same group. What does that amount to? In effect, less than 1% of the companies were able to control 40% of the entire network, according to one of the systems analysts, James Glatfelder. These super connectors were mainly banks. The top 20 were led by Barclays at the top of the list, followed by a few I'd never heard of, maybe because they found new ways to put big initial names to mask the company's identities. I'm talking about Capital Group Companies Incorporated and FMR Corporation, formerly Fidelity Investments, AXA, once called Equitable Insurance, and State Street Corporation, Boston's State Street Bank, followed by J.P. Morgan Chase at number 6. Now, here in the richest country on earth, let's dive down to examine what's happening on the bottom of the pile. I know this chapter has a lot of statistics to take in, but they're important to digest, though you may need to take some Tums. In mid-December 2011, the latest census data showed that a record number of Americans, almost 1 out of 2, are either in poverty or barely getting by on earnings that categorize them as low income. The Census Bureau had earlier reported that our country's poverty rate spiked to 15.1% in 2010, the fourth straight year of increase. That comes out to about 46.2 million Americans, and 1 out of every 5 American kids. In 2010, 1 out of 7 households, 17.2 million, didn't have enough food to put on the table. The total number of people living below the poverty line, an income of $22,314 for a family of 4 in 2010, is now at the highest level in the 52 years officials have been gathering these statistics. Meanwhile, the median household income fell by 2.3%, so $49,445 between 2009 and 2010, with the worst off 10% seeing a decline of 12.1%. If you think this is an urban or isolated rural phenomenon, you're wrong. Poverty is increasing faster in the suburbs than anywhere else in the country. For the first time ever, the Bureau of Labor Statistics says that there were 2.7 million more suburban households below the poverty line than city households. And over the previous decade, the suburbs had seen a 53% increase in poverty. There are 18.5 million vacant homes in this country. Banks have foreclosed approximately 8 million since 2007, and it's likely that millions more are to come. There are about 3.5 million homeless Americans, many of them veterans of our misguided wars. That figure includes about 1.6 million kids, most of them under the age of 7. Doesn't it start to make you mad, hearing all of this, about what is happening to our kids and families and vets? Remember when this was the country where we were all in the same boat? And now it is looking like the Titanic with the rich folks still dancing on the upper decks. A record 45 million Americans are now living on food stamps, a weekly stipend to help them make ends meet. That's nearly 1 out of 6, and it's continuing to rise. According to the mayors in 29 cities, more than 1 out of 4 people who need emergency food assistance didn't get it. It's all run by a program out of the Department of Agriculture called the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. That's right, SNAP for short. They haven't released the figures on how many people have been SNAPed, but it's sure not decreasing. The food stamp numbers actually started rising in 2008 when Bush's recession began. With more and more people out of work, the numbers have soared since then. One reason Newt Gingrich calls Obama the food stamp president. Seems to me like it was Bush and his bankster friends who started the rush to food stamps when they crashed our economy. For 90% of Americans, wages are steadily declining. Of course, that's for the ones who still hold jobs. of 13.3 million unemployed Americans now searching for work, 5.7 million have been looking for more than 6 months, while millions more have given up altogether. At the same time, U.S. millionaire households hold at least $45.9 trillion in wealth, and the majority of that money belongs to the upper one-tenth of 1% of our population. My mind boggles. I honestly can't comprehend how much $1 trillion is, let alone $45.9 trillion. $1 trillion, so I've read, is equal to 1,000 billion. So, if you multiply that by 45.9... My calculator just crashed. I'm taking this figure from a report that came out in August 2011 by David DeGraw, aptly titled Analysis of Financial Terrorism in America. By comparison, he notes that the entire cost of food stamps for Americans in 2010 was a mere $65 billion. Of course, that $45.9 trillion figure includes about $6.3 trillion that's been stashed away in offshore accounts. So I guess the greediest don't have everything over the neediest. Since that money doesn't get declared, the result is a tax revenue loss to the Treasury of about $337 billion a year. This report is mind-blowing, even for those of us who have heard the figure about the top 1% owning 40% of all the wealth. Overall, the richest 400 people in America, all of them billionaires, possess as much money as the bottom 50% of Americans combined, some 154 million people. The top tax bracket for annual income starts at $50 million and up. There are only 74 Americans in that group. Now get this. Back in 2008, before things really went south for the economy, their average income was $91.2 million. The next year, 2009, that soared to $518.8 million each, which means that while everybody else was mired in the recession, the richest 74 increased their income by over five times in the space of a year. They were making more bucks than 19 million workers combined, on a scale of about $10 million a week. Today, the average CEO pay is 350 times what the average American worker makes. In 2010, Fortune 500 CEOs saw their average pay escalate by 36.5%. So, as Butch Cassidy once said to the Sundance Kid, who are those guys? Or, if you prefer a line from the movie version of The Grapes of Wrath, who do we shoot? In fairness to Wall Street, it must be pointed out that no less than six Walton kids, heirs to the Walmart fortune, are on the top 400 list. Their combined worth is almost $70 billion, which calculates out to the total wealth of the entire bottom 30% of Americans. They spend a portion of that fortune lobbying to cut their estate taxes, which President Obama agreed to do for all those rich Americans saddled so unfairly with a death tax. The CEO of Walmart earns, if you can believe this, $19,000 an hour. At the same time, his million or so employees have to work on holidays for between $8 to $10 an hour. This is aided and abetted by the fact that Walmart imports more than $20 billion a year in products from sweatshops in China. For corporate CEOs, 2010 was a record year on Wall Street, their compensation going up by more than 30%. They pulled in about $149 billion that year. Topping the heap was Jamie Dimon, CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, at $90 million in take-home pay. Vikram Pandit, CEO of Citigroup, wasn't far behind with $80 million, even though he might hit over $200 million in added compensation and bonuses. These are the guys we bailed out with our taxes after they crashed the economy. Lest we forget, there's Goldman Sachs, or Government Sachs, as they're nicknamed around the Washington Beltway, as David DeGraw put it. Former Goldman Sachs CEO and Bush Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson had already amassed at least $700 million prior to moving to the U.S. Treasury in 2006. Current Goldman Sachs CEO Lloyd Blankfein and a few other top executives at Goldman Sachs just received $111.3 million in bonuses. Blankfein just took home $24.3 million as part of a $67.9 million bonus he was awarded. Goldman's president, Gary Cohn, took home $24 million as part of a $66.9 million bonus he was awarded. Goldman's CFO, David Vinier, and former co-president, John Winkelried, both took home over $20 million in bonuses. Too big to whale? Not when it came to getting government bailout money for their companies in 2008-2009. A report issued January 2011 by the Special Inspector General's office keeping tabs on where the money went says that U.S. taxpayers are still owed $132.9 billion that the companies haven't repaid. This is going to go on for years. We'll get to more on the bailout beneficiaries in due course. I propose a new episode of Let's Make a Deal. Between 2000 and 2011, in the mergers and acquisitions department, among the top financial advisors, Goldman Sachs ranks numero uno with 396 deals worth a cool $640 billion. Next comes Morgan Stanley, 308 deals worth $498 billion, followed by J.P. Morgan Chase, Credit Suisse, and Bank of America Merrill Lynch. As for the top legal advisors, leading the field with 135 deals worth $401 billion is none other than Sullivan & Cromwell, the law firm that gave the Dulles brothers, CIA's Allen and State's John Foster, their start in the 1920s and went on to notoriety in the rise of Nazi Germany. But if the profiteering of the big banks might seem a bit abstract, the healthcare story will most certainly hit home for you. Dear listener, we Americans happen to pay more in medical expenses than any other country on the planet. In fact, twice as much as most, and generally with worse results. Without health insurance, we're sunk. But more than 50 million Americans can't afford the escalating costs of the premiums. Think about this. Over 60% of all personal bankruptcies are the result of medical bills. So how are the health insurance CEOs making out? Almost as good as the Wall Street titans. According to a story in the Los Angeles Times, leaders of Cigna, Humana, United Health, WellPoint, and Aetna received nearly $200 million in compensation in 2009, while the companies sought rate increases as high as 39%. Prime example, Cigna paid CEO H. Edward Hanway and his successor, David Cordani, $136.3 million in 2009. And let's not leave out the big oil companies. While the rest of us have seen prices soaring at the pump, the top five companies raked in $101 billion in profits during the first 9 months of 2011. ExxonMobil, Chevron, Shell, BP, and ConocoPhillips were on track to surpass their record-setting profits of 2007 and 2008 before the recession hit. Meanwhile, their chief lobbyist, the American Petroleum Institute, is fighting hard to keep those tax breaks that stand to be worth another $40 billion over the next decade. Once a gusher, always a gusher. That's our Congress's motto, apparently. And every time the gas prices go up at the pump, big oil rakes in even more money. Heads they win, tails we lose. When it comes to taxes, if I may be so bold, I find the reality rather revolting. A comprehensive new study released in November 2011 revealed that 78 out of America's 280 most profitable Fortune 500 companies paid zero federal income taxes in at least one of the last 3 years. At the same time, those 280 companies were making almost $1.4 trillion in pre-tax profits. Oh, and receiving almost $223 billion in tax subsidies from the government. Topping the list of those recipients was Wells Fargo, $18 billion over 3 years, followed by AT&T, $14.5 billion, Verizon, $12.3 billion, General Electric, $8.4 billion, IBM, $8.3 billion, ExxonMobil, $4.1 billion, and Boeing, $3.6 billion. Another study found that 265 big corporations avoided $42.7 billion in taxes from 2008 to 2010. For comparison's sake, that's enough money to hire more than 1 million teachers instead of laying them off because state budgets can't afford them. Another report looked at 100 publicly traded U.S. corporations with the highest paid CEOs. It turns out that 25 of those guys made more in salary and other compensation in 2010 than their companies paid in federal income taxes on the annual financial statements. Those same companies averaged global profits of $1.9 billion. Since we're naming names, among the top beneficiaries were Verizon CEO Ivan Seidenberg, Cablevision's James Dolan, and eBay's John J. Donahoe. Donahoe got a compensation package worth over $12 million, while eBay received a federal refund of $113 million. Good old Verizon. Over the past 3 years, the company earned $21.5 billion in pre-tax U.S. profits and gave its top five execs $181 million. At the same time, Verizon dumped 40,000 workers and is demanding $1 billion from 45,000 more who are union-represented, a $22,000 cut per worker. And good old Countrywide Financial, the fraud-riddled mortgage lender that got picked up for chump change by Bank of America in 08. Eileen Foster, who used to be a top executive there, told 60 Minutes that loan officers were compensated regardless of the quality of the loan and that the company's recycle bins were full of signatures that had been cut off of one document and put onto another and then photocopied, you know, or faxed, before putting a heavy-duty black mark on the word recycling. In plain language, that's called fraud. Wonder if any of these banksters will see the inside of a jail. Somehow I doubt it. The Analysis of Financial Terrorism in America report also takes a look at the taxation trail. A total of 1,470 Americans earned more than $1 million in 2009 and didn't pay any taxes. Not so long ago, in 1970, millionaires were accustomed to paying about 70% of their annual income to taxes. By 1995, the wealthiest 400 Americans were paying 30%. In 2009, it was 22.4%. Today, that's dropped to 18%. Note that this is income tax only. The rate is even lower if you take into account 15% capital gains rate, meaning that the super rich in our superpower are paying fewer taxes overall than your average secretary. It's all structured so that the very wealthy don't earn their income from pulling down a salary. That's what stock options are all about. Cash it out and pay capital gains tax, as opposed to the income tax rate. Among politicians, Mitt Romney admits to paying about 13% of his megabucks in taxes, though with capital gains it's likely less than that. There are other ways you can dodge the tax code, like Romney's offshore accounts in Bermuda and the Cayman Islands. With unemployment still at more than 8%, if an average American worker is lucky enough to get a regular paycheck, he's sure not likely to get much of a raise. Compare that to what's happening with the top exec CEOs at 200 big companies analyzed by Equilar, an executive compensation data firm. Their median pay was $10.8 million in 2010, a 23% gain from the year before. One windfall write-off for both the corporations and their execs has to do with stock options. Some CEOs take token salaries and live off their ownership stakes. These stock riches don't show up on the current pay lists, but they can be huge, according to the New York Times. Warren E. Buffett, for instance, saw his stock holdings rise last year by 16% to $46 billion. Other longtime chief executives or founders who are sitting on billions of paper profits include Jeffrey P. Bezos of Amazon.com and Michael S. Dell, the founder of Dell. After the market collapsed in 08, hundreds of CEOs got granted unusually large packages of stock options from their companies. And through a loophole in our tax code, the same companies can claim huge deductions in future years for having granted those options, much more in write-offs than the options were worth, which, more than incidentally, will deprive the federal government of tens of billions of dollars in revenue over the next decade. This is patently absurd, especially at a time when the deficit is spiraling out of control and the big talk in D.C. is about cutting social programs like Medicare. So, The good times for CEOs and their companies just keep on keeping on. Don't get me wrong. I know a lot of good people who happen to have money, and of course I've made my share. But we're talking about not only a huge gap between the rich and the poor, but a monumental scam that Bill Moyers recently called perversion of democracy. He added, "Our politicians are little more than money launderers in the trafficking of power and policy. Fewer than 6 degrees of separation from the spirit and tactics of Tony Soprano." Pretty strong words from LBJ's former press secretary. This all reminds me of some lyrics from Pretty Boy Floyd, written by Woody Guthrie. It's his 100th birthday in 2012. "Yes, as through this world I've wandered, I've seen lots of funny men. Some will rob you with a six-gun, and some with a fountain pen. And as through your life you travel, yes, as through your life you roam, you won't never see an outlaw drive a family from their home." Reminds me, too, of Gordon Gekko's "Greed is Good" speech from the movie Wall Street. "I create nothing, I own," he said, and at another point wondered aloud, "Now, you're not naive enough to think we're living in a democracy, are you, buddy?" Before we take a long look at how money and politics has corrupted our system, and to borrow another line from the movie Network, when will we the people rise up and shout that they're mad as hell and not going to take it anymore? All Occupy, all the time. Chapter 5. What the Two Gangs Do for the Rich. Let me return to our founders for a moment. What John Adams feared in America's future was what he called an aristocratic despotism, the possibility of the rich, the well-born, and the able acquiring an influence among the people that will soon be too much for simple honesty and plain sense. He wrote about the weakness, the folly, the pride, the vanity, the selfishness, the artifice, the unbounded ambition, the unfeeling cruelty of a majority of those, in all nations, who are allowed an aristocratical influence. No wonder there was a lively debate in the newborn Congress about what to call the new head of state. His Excellency and His Elective Highness were both suggested, strangely enough, by Vice President Adams, despite his worry about aristocratical influence. Maybe in response, Adams' opponents called him his rotundity. Both Excellency and Highness were rejected as sounding too royal. Congress went with a straightforward, no-nonsense suggestion of James Madison, Mr. President. Madison was also afraid that the spirit of speculation would result in a government operating by corrupt influence, substituting the motive of private interest in place of public duty. And Thomas Jefferson expressed the hope that we shall crush in its birth the aristocracy of our moneyed corporations, which dare already to challenge our government to a trial of strength and to bid defiance to the laws of our country. Theodore Roosevelt spoke in 1907 about certain malefactors of great wealth who combined to bring about as much financial stress as possible in order to discredit the policy of the government and secure a reversal of that policy, so that they may enjoy unmolested the fruits of their own evil doing. I regard this contest as one to determine who shall rule this free country, the people through their governmental agents, or a few ruthless and domineering men whose wealth makes them peculiarly formidable because they hide behind the breastworks of corporate organization. Of course, the founders didn't all see eye to eye. John Jay, who became the first Chief Justice of the United States, is quoted by his brother as having said, "Those who own the country ought to govern it." I'm sure the majority of today's justices would be nodding their heads in unison to that one, but we'll get to that in due course. According to my Merriam-Webster's dictionary, corporatism is defined as the organization of a society into industrial and professional corporations serving as organs of political representation and exercising control over person and activities within their jurisdiction. Now let's expand that a little bit to what Italian dictator Benito Mussolini once said. Fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism because it is a merger of state and corporate power. Today in America, we're living in a corporatocracy, or plutocracy, or if you prefer, an oligarchy. In this chapter, I want to delve into how the rich buy influence from their ever-willing partners in politics to the point where Spencer Baucus, chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, has said, "My view is that Washington and the regulators are there to serve the banks." The result being complete impotence by the government when it pretends to address the various financial issues plaguing our country. It's not just federal, but at the state level, too. I can speak from personal experience. People from both parties went public in the last governor's race in Minnesota and said that a major mistake was made when we overturned my budget in 2003. What they did to me, they did feeling that the economy would rebound back big. They gambled, threw the dice, and craps came up. We've fallen a long way in less than a decade. Through most of my term, we'd had a budget surplus, and I was able to provide citizens the largest tax rebate any state had ever given. In July 2011, my home state was facing a $5 billion budget gap. When the entire biannual budget is only $32 billion, that's a substantial chunk. You're looking at about 20% of your budget that has to be fixed either with taxes raised or services cut. All because the two parties did what they always do, made political decisions without caring about people, just their parties. Tim Pawlenty, who became governor after I decided not to run again, wouldn't increase taxes on the wealthy, but he cut $2.7 billion from health care and the University of Minnesota under a declared emergency. The state Supreme Court in 2010 ruled that his unilateral cuts had violated our Minnesota Constitution. In 2011, the solution to the budget gap from the Republicans in the Minnesota legislature ended up shutting down the state government because they wouldn't raise taxes on the 7,700 people in Minnesota who make over $1 million a year. More than 40 state agencies closed down, including the state parks, during the 4th of July. Some 22,000 workers were placed on furlough. We became a national example of political dysfunction. By the time an agreement was reached without any tax increases, but with the state delaying more aid to our schools, and the shutdown ended after 20 days, lost revenues were in the millions. Minnesota held a mirror up to the bigger picture. For several years now, federal government officials have said time and again that we had to shoot hundreds of billions to big banks in order to save our financial system, and supposedly also to benefit Main Street. Yeah, well, I liked this summation by Edward J. Cain, a finance professor at Boston College, when he appeared before a Senate banking panel in August 2011. Our representative democracy espouses the principle that all men and women are equal under the law. During the housing bubble and the economic meltdown that the bursting bubble brought about, the interests of domestic and foreign financial institutions were much better represented than the interests of society as a whole. Robert Reich, the Secretary of Labor under President Clinton, wrote recently, "Everyone knows the biggest banks are too big to fail, and yet despite this, Congress won't put a cap on the size of the banks." The assets of the four biggest, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Citigroup, and Wells Fargo, now equal 62% of total commercial bank assets. That's up from 54% 5 years ago. Throw in Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, and these six leviathans preside over the American economy like Roman emperors. Representative democracy? Roman emperors? I'm glad some people are laying it out in those terms. How do they get away with it? Their daddy Warbucks in government is the Federal Reserve, our central bank, that controls U.S. monetary policy and has for almost 100 years. So just how unaccountable are they? In August 2011, the first ever audit of the Federal Reserve showed they'd provided over $1 trillion in emergency loans between late 2007 and mid-2010 to the financial sector. Then it came out in November 2011 that while Congress was debating whether to bail out the banksters back in 2008 with a $700 billion blank check, the Fed was already giving the six biggest banks under the table no-strings-attached loans of $7.77 trillion. The banks then used the low interest rates charged by the Fed to bring in another $13 billion in income. The Fed gave Morgan Stanley $107 billion in September 2008, Citigroup almost $100 billion in January 2009, and Bear Stearns $30 billion to see it through its 2008 shotgun marriage with J.P. Morgan. A later analysis by a Ford Foundation project of all the various liquidity swaps, mortgage-backed security purchases, and the like, showed that the total emergency assistance from the Fed to both domestic and foreign entities is no less than $29.606 trillion. That mind-blowing number is more than twice the U.S. GDP for 2010. All this thanks to the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, who aren't elected by anybody, but are really more powerful than the government. The current president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, William Dudley, kept his investments in AIG and General Electric while the Fed was simultaneously giving bailout funds to both companies. And nobody but Bernie Sanders, the independent U.S. senator from Vermont, raised the conflict of interest card. The former New York Fed president, Tim Geithner, was connected to Goldman Sachs through a series of hedge funds. He went on to run Obama's Treasury Department. "The main problem," said Randall Ray, an economics professor from the University of Missouri, Kansas City, "is the lack of congressional oversight and the way the Fed seemed to pick winners who would be protected at any cost. Remember Fannie and Freddie, the mortgage honchos, which got about $150 billion in bailout money and exist today thanks to the largesse of future taxpayers." On his website, Ron Paul has this quote from none other than Henry Ford. "It is well that the people of the nation do not understand our banking and monetary system, for if they did, I believe there would be a revolution before tomorrow morning." Paul pulls no punches about the Federal Reserve, which he wrote in the Wall Street Journal has caused every single boom and bust that has occurred in this country since the bank's creation in 1913. The Fed's actions have had one aim: to keep prices elevated at bubble levels, thus ensuring that bad debt remains on the books and failing firms remain in business, albatrosses around the market's neck. If the Fed would stop intervening and distorting the market and would allow the functioning of a truly free market that deals with profit and loss, our economy could recover. The continued existence of an organization that can create trillions of dollars out of thin air to purchase financial assets and prop up a fundamentally insolvent banking system is a black mark on an economy that professes to be free. In late January 2011, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission finally released its awaited report on the debt crisis of a few years earlier. It was called a confusing and contradictory mess, as impenetrable as the collateralized debt obligations at the core of the crisis. The commission's investigation was spiritless and sometimes plain wrong. Unbelievably, the Republicans proposed removing the term Wall Street from the report altogether. As it turns out, 30 big U.S. corporations spent more money lobbying than they paid in federal taxes from 2008 to 2010. In fact, 29 of these companies managed to pay no federal income taxes at all. That's because they're job creators, right? Keep in mind that the tax code calls for 35% of corporate profits to go toward taxes. But those same 29 companies got tax rebates instead. In General Electric's case, nearly $5 billion on top of a $140 billion bailout on the way to global 2010 profits of $14 billion. The combined profits of those 29 outfits hit $164 billion and the rebates almost $11 billion. How can this be, you ask? Well, the most blatant recent example I know in terms of what goes on inside the revolving door between financial bigwigs and politicians is the case of John S. Corzine. He'd been a lot of things to a lot of people in the past. He'd joined Goldman Sachs as a young bond trader back in 1975 and eventually ascended to the top with the rep as a big-risk, big-profit guy. After Corzine lost out in a Goldman power struggle in 1999 with Hank Paulson, soon to be W's Treasury Secretary, Corzine went on to become a U.S. Senator from New Jersey and then the state's governor. And after he lost a re-election race in 2010, he ended up the CEO of a little-known brokerage house called MF Global. There, Corzine succeeded in stopping a new federal regulation that would have put a crimp in risky trades using customers' money, just like the one he set out to make. Never one to shy away from a challenge, Corzine placed a $6.3 billion bet on the sovereign debt of 5 European countries. Bad timing, John. It wasn't long before MF Global was up for sale, and then filing for bankruptcy in the fall of 2011. When Corzine was subpoenaed to testify before a congressional committee, he said he was stunned to find out that about $1 billion of customer money couldn't be found. You heard right. $1 billion somehow misplaced. What was more than a little embarrassing was when a subsequent witness said that MF Global had used $175 million in customer funds to lend from one arm of the firm to another, and that Corzine knew about it. Here's how they worked it. 4 days before the company fell apart, MF Global unloaded hundreds of millions of dollars worth of securities to Goldman Sachs, the behemoth that Corzine previously headed up. According to some ex-MF Global employees, the deal was cleared by J.P. Morgan Chase, which was letting the company draw down a $1.2 billion revolving line of credit at the time. It all happened lickety-split in the realm of the Titans. While it is unclear what type of assets Goldman bought from MF Global, global customers have not yet received an estimated $900 million from their accounts, which remain frozen as regulators search for missing funds. But don't bet on good old boy John Corzine ending up in the hoosegow anytime soon. Columnist Frank Rich puts it like this. The Obama administration seems not to have a prosecutorial gene. It's shy about calling a fraud when it occurs in high finance. Corporations too big to prosecute became the order of the day under George W. Bush, but it's ongoing. There's a veritable who's who that's never been called to account for illegal activities ranging from bribery to tax evasion to just about everything in between. Among others, deferred prosecution has benefited Boeing, AIG, AOL, Halliburton, BP, Health South, Daimler Chrysler, Wachovia, Merrill Lynch, Pfizer, UBS, and Barclays Bank. Remember the savings and loan crisis in the 1980s? Well, more than 800 bank officials went to jail then for criminal activity. Not this time, baby. As early as 2008, before the public had any idea what had been going on, the FBI had scaled back a plan to investigate mortgage fraud. One of the worst offenders was Angelo R. Mozzillo, the CEO of Countrywide Financial based in L.A. The U.S. attorney there dropped an investigation of Mozzillo after he cut a deal with the Securities Exchange Commission, SEC. Mozzillo paid $22.5 million in penalties without admitting or denying the accusations against him. The SEC is notorious for lack of enforcement, so much so that a federal judge who's overseeing a $285 million settlement between Citigroup and the SEC, a deal that would close the book on the fact that the bank deceived investors in the sale of mortgage securities for over $1 billion, wondered aloud whether the SEC has an interest in what the truth is. An analysis by the New York Times of SEC investigations over the last decade found nearly 350 instances where the agency has given big Wall Street institutions and other financial companies a pass, and also grants waivers whereby the companies continue to use rules that let them instantly raise money publicly without waiting weeks for government approvals. The SEC had all its teeth extracted some time ago, and those few slaps it meets out are pretty damn limp-wristed. The same federal judge just mentioned, Jed S. Rakoff, tossed out an earlier paltry settlement between the SEC and Bank of America over how the company acquired Merrill Lynch. Almost all the biggest financial corporations, including Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Bank of America, have settled fraud cases by promising they would never again violate an anti-fraud law, only to have the SEC conclude they did it again a few years later. But the SEC hasn't brought a single contempt charge against these guys for a decade. You can take it to the bank. That punishment ain't gonna happen. A warning, maybe, but no citation. And any executives named as defendants? No way, Jose. The days when the fellows running Enron and WorldCom got called on the carpet are pretty much over. Solomon L. Weisenberg, once in charge of a financial institution's fraud unit at the Justice Department, sums it up. Traditionally, a bank would tell the Department of Justice when an employee engaged in crimes. but what do you do when the bank itself is run by a criminal enterprise? Keep in mind that the SEC is the government agency that's supposed to make sure the street gangs keep and retain records on their activities, and a number of enforcement cases have been brought when they didn't. Except it turns out to be a pot calling the kettle black situation, because it's come out that the SEC illegally destroyed files and documents related to thousands of early-stage investigations over the last 20 years, against the likes of Bernie Madoff, Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, B of A, and Lehman Brothers. You don't need a scorecard to list the players. The SEC claims they saw the light and changed the no-search-but-destroy policy in 2010. Elizabeth Warren, now a candidate for the Senate against Scott Brown in Massachusetts, and a rare people's advocate, wrote recently, "The big banks and their allies followed a now familiar game plan, launch an offensive against anyone trying to enforce the law with rigor, work overtime to block serious investigation of illegal activity, and persuade the government to accept a slap-on-the-wrist settlement to absolve their violations of the law. Instead, the street is suing via their big lobbyists to overturn whatever government rules it doesn't like." In December, they filed one against the Commodities Futures Trading Commission because the new Dodd-Frank law authorizes it to put limits on their speculative trading. But Wall Street is claiming the commission's cost-benefit analysis was inadequate. Translation: don't touch my profits, buddy. A year earlier, Wall Street sued the SEC on the same grounds after the SEC tried making it easier for shareholders to nominate directors to their companies. This is despite the Dodd-Frank bill being filled with loopholes, big enough for Wall Street executives and traders to drive their Ferraris through, as Robert Reich wrote. AIG is the insurance giant that made reckless bets on mortgage-backed securities that went south. But they're also one of a handful of bailed-out big companies that got granted a special waiver by the Treasury in 2008, which allows their net operating losses to offset any taxes owed to the government. That waiver, to a company that claimed more than $19 billion in profits for only the last 3 months of 2011, will most likely let them avoid paying anything in taxes for a decade. But in a lawsuit that really takes the cake, the former head of AIG, Maurice Hank Greenberg, has filed a $25 billion case against the federal government for taking an 80% interest in his insurance behemoth during the financial crisis without due process or just compensation, in alleged violation of the Fifth Amendment. So the government, which bailed out AIG to the tune of $182.3 billion, is now being demanded to pay the company's shareholders since AIG's stock price has dropped 98% since mid-2007. But if corporations are people, why the fuck not? But if these lawsuits are bass-ackwards, unless you're the best double thinker on the planet, remember Orwell's 1984, War is Peace, the corporatists in Congress are right there cheerleading. After a bipartisan super committee was established to deal with the deficit, the Republicans refused to hike taxes on the wealthiest Americans. In fact, they wanted to cut them even below their current bargain basement level. I mean, you'd think their clients shopped at Walmart or Target. How far do Obama and the other Democrats have to cave? The original grand bargain that the Bloods rejected would have cut $1 trillion in domestic and defense spending and $650 billion from Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, all because it would have raised tax revenues by $1.2 trillion. When 3 million people were set to lose their unemployment insurance and were plenty pissed off about it, the Republicans ultimately quit stonewalling in December. Things have come to such a dastardly pass that there's been a bill introduced in the House with more than 200 co-signers as of last December called the Regulations from the Executive in Need of Scrutiny Act, REINS, RAINS for short, which I suppose is their play on words for reining in the government. What this bill would do is stop any major regulation issued by a federal agency and costing more than $100 million from taking effect unless it received approval from both houses of Congress and the President. Many such rules are issued every year, involving everything from food safety to efficiency standards for cars. In a wipeout of the legislative process, one house can effectively undo a law by killing off regulations that carry out the law without the consent of the other parties involved in its creation. Wow, Remember when Congress used to enact the laws and then the executive branch would negotiate with stakeholders and write detailed regulations? Rains would delay product safety rules affecting family products, like toys and cribs, complicate the FDA's regulation of food and prescription drugs, and slow delivery of Social Security and Medicare. There's another bill, called the Regulatory Accountability Act, which would subject agencies to nearly boundless inquiries into the cost of new regulations and give corporations numerous opportunities to delay rulemaking indefinitely. Few major rules would ever see the light of day. Government Sachs spent $4.6 million in 2010 lobbying Congress to water down the Dodd-Frank law, which tries to exert a wee bit of control over the $600 trillion derivatives market, much of it on hired guns from major Washington lobbying firms, including former Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott, Republican, Mississippi, and former House Minority Leader Richard A. Gephardt, Democrat, Missouri. Always an equal opportunity employer. As for corporate whistleblowers, few as they may be, they pretty much get the silent treatment from Washington. Of 1,273 complaints filed between 2002 and 2008 by employees who spoke out and were retaliated against by their companies, only 17 times did the government rule for the whistleblower. 841 of the complaints were dismissed without even being heard. Eileen Foster was a senior exec at Countrywide Financial, who uncovered massive fraud and talked about it on 60 Minutes. But nobody in government saw fit to contact her afterward. The Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act is supposed to encourage reporting violations to the SEC and even providing rewards to Wall Street whistleblowers. But a bill introduced by New York Blood Representative Michael Grimm called, get this, the Whistleblower Improvement Act would require these do-gooders to first report the problems to their employers before even thinking about tattling to the government. This would be like requiring police officers to tip off suspects before they begin an investigation, as the Project on Government Oversight puts it. Watch for the Grimm Act to resurface in Congress's near future. Then there's the story of Layla Wydler, who in 2003 sent a letter to the SEC about the Stanford Financial Group, her former employer, that she alleged was involved in a lingering corporate fraud scandal perpetrated as a massive Ponzi scheme that will destroy the life savings of many, damage the reputation of all associated parties, ridicule securities and banking authorities, and shame the United States of America. She sent copies to the trade group supposedly responsible for enforcing the regs, along with media including the Washington Post and Wall Street Journal. Nobody responded. Over 4 years later, it came out that Stanford had indeed orchestrated a $7 billion Ponzi scheme, which cost thousands of defrauded investors their savings. In March 2012, Texas financier Robert Allen Stanford finally was convicted by a Houston federal court after being charged with defrauding almost 30,000 investors in 113 countries by way of dishing out $7 billion in false, high-interest certificates of deposit at his Caribbean-based bank on the island of Antigua. The media trumpeted about Stanford's private yachts and the castle he bought a girlfriend in Florida, but they didn't say a word about what Bill Moyer's journal first revealed several years back. He bankrolled junkets to Antigua's balmy shores for several members of Congress, including Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn and New York Democratic Congressman Charlie Rangel, then chair of the powerful House Ways and Means Committee. Stanford partied with Nancy Pelosi and Bill Clinton at the Democratic National Convention in 2008. And when Tom DeLay was still House Majority Leader, he flew the friendly skies in Stanford's private jet 16 times in 3 years, including a trip to Houston for DeLay's arraignment on money laundering charges. Sir Allen also showered millions of dollars on political campaigns, much of it in the very year Congress was debating a bill to curb financial fraud. Two of the biggest recipients were Democratic Senator Bill Nelson and Republican John McCain, one of the original Keating Five. Three key Democrats on the Senate Banking Committee got checks from Stanford, too. Surprise, surprise, the reform bill never got out of the Senate. Barack Obama, John Boehner, and Harry Reid, along with the national fundraising committees for both gangs, also were blessed with Stanford's largesse. even though some have returned their contributions to a court-appointed receiver that's supposed to be refunding the defrauded investors. Roughly $154,000 recovered from elected officials is a fraction of the $1.8 million missing. And in a bit of hypocrisy that takes the cake, the two gangs' national campaign committees are appealing to a higher court about having to return what Stanford gave them. While tax rates are at a 60-year low, our budget deficit keeps right on growing. During the Summer 11 battle over the debt ceiling, Republicans tried to sneak in riders that would essentially have blocked the EPA and the Interior Department from doing their jobs. No less a personage than the Oracle of Omaha, mega-billionaire Warren Buffett, came right out and told Congress's Supercommittee on Reducing the Deficit to quit coddling him and his rich buddies. Buffett pointed out that he paid a lesser tax rate, 17%, than anybody else in his office, and he didn't think that was right. He called for rolling back the millionaire tax cuts. Maybe some in the government could listen up if they weren't so busy raking it in. Like Illinois Senator Richard Durbin said in a rare moment of congressional candor back in 09, the big financial groups around Capitol Hill frankly own the place. Generally speaking, you don't hear many donkeys braying or elephants trumpeting unless it's to toot their own horns. No, it's all about knowing who's going to add the most sweetener to your honeypot. Has there been any legislation to put the brakes on the high finance racketeers? None of the so-called legislative efforts, Dodd-Frank or you name it, have come close to pushing the kind of regulation that's needed. Obama, in his 2008 campaign for presidency, took a huge amount of money from the financial industry. So you think he's going to tie their hands in a real way? Otherwise, why wouldn't he have given that interim appointment to Elizabeth Warren to run the new Consumer Protection Agency that supposedly was going to cut some nuts off? Nope. Obama's backers didn't want Mrs. Oversight to get any real power. These behemoth corporations are still too big to fail, let alone jail. And you can bet that if another J.P. Morgan or Goldman Sachs starts to go under, they'll get saved for fear of crashing the economy. Nothing that really caused our dilemma has changed. These two gangs are definitely equal opportunity pushers, and I use that term the same way it refers to the cartels. Protecting the rights of corporations to pollute is another big-ticket item. In 2011, the Republican House voted 191 times to undercut clean air and water laws while blocking efforts to limit global warming, protect public lands, and guard against future oil spills, and to reject attempts to strengthen the regulations. After all, the mantra goes, regulations cost jobs, and all they're out to do is help the working guy. In December 2011, a study from Germany called Bankrolling Climate Change identified the top 20 banks who financially support the coal industry. A typical-sized 600-megawatt coal-fired power plant costs over $2 billion, and since 2005, this report found $308 billion in coal financing. The biggest offenders? Round up the usual suspects, the bailed-out boys, J.P. Morgan, Citibank, and Bank of America. And the doublespeak is staggering. J.P. Morgan claims they are helping the world transition to a low-carbon economy. Citi calls itself, on its website, the most innovative bank in climate change. Bank of America calls global climate change the most formidable challenge we are facing. One thing you gotta say for BP, at least they're honest about it. They shut down their solar business in December, saying they can't make any money selling panels while they're still spending $20 billion a year developing oil and gas. As Robert F. Kennedy Jr. put it recently, the same DOE, Department of Energy Loan Guarantee Program, that supported new solar projects gave an astonishing $8.3 billion loan guarantee, many times the size of the solar projects to Southern Company, to build two nuclear power plants. Nuclear power is an industry with a product so expensive it cannot compete in any version of free market capitalism. Big Nuke is totally dependent on massive, monstrous public and government subsidies at every stage of its life. Oil is a close second. A comprehensive inventory of oil subsidies by former California EPA chief Terry Tamminen in his acclaimed book, Lives Per Gallon, calculates U.S. subsidies to the oil industry at upward of $1 trillion annually. In 2009, the American Clean Energy and Security Act was introduced in the House. It would have established an emissions trading plan similar to the European Union's, aimed at limiting the amount of greenhouse gases. But the Heritage Foundation and the American Petroleum Institute, API, came out against the bill, claiming it would raise taxes, and thus the price of gasoline and related energy expenses. Bad for the bottom line. The API spent millions greasing the lawmakers who eventually killed the bill in the Senate. PACs from Big Oil and Big Gas gushed and flatulated $6.6 million to federal candidates from January 09 until June 10, about 60% going to the Bloods and the other 40% to the Crips. One thing both gangs agree on is keeping the military budget intact. Over this past decade, our military spending has gone from $300 billion to $700 billion. During the same time period, we've spent over $7.6 trillion on military and homeland security, and we're trying to find some place to reduce the deficit? The majority of Americans, according to a poll taken by Reuters, are in favor of cutting defense spending, which now exceeds that of all other countries in the world combined and consumes more than one-third of the federal budget. And part of that involves what the Government Accountability Office has said are staggering cost overruns by the Pentagon. Their contractors are getting away with fraud on a scale bigger than Wall Street, if that's possible. It seems that 80% of the 3- and 4-star officers who retired from 2004 to 2008 went to work as either consultants or defense industry execs. I'm 60 years old, and my country has been at war more than half of my life. If we hadn't fought all these wars, do you think our economics would be as bad as they are today? Another lie that the government is perpetrating is that when you join the military, it's to protect us, the average U.S. citizens. No, you're the muscle arm of the corporations when you put on that uniform. I challenge the government on all the wars since World War II to give me one example where the United States was in danger of being invaded and having our lifestyles being changed. The domino effect of communism proved not to be true. That was what they sold us for a while. Today, they're selling us patriotism, and that's false. The military today is there to push corporate interests throughout the world. When corporations are threatened, the U.S. military goes in to quell the threat. In some ways, things haven't changed all that much since the 1930s, when Major General Smedley Butler, the most decorated Marine in American history, put out this message in a speech to the American Legion. I spent 33 years being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, and the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer for capitalism. He listed having helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers, and helping make Mexico safe for American oil interests, and the Dominican Republic for American sugar interests, among others. Butler came right out and told veterans that war was largely a matter of money. Bankers lend money to foreign countries, and when they cannot repay, the president sends Marines to get it. I know. I've been in 11 of these expeditions. But more and more, our foreign wars now involve the use of private contractors. In 2007, when the Iraq War was at its peak, there were more than 180,000 civilians, American and foreign, including Iraqi, being paid by we, the taxpayers, compared to 160,000 regular soldiers. And that didn't even count the private security companies, PSCs, like Blackwater, DynCorp International, and Triple Canopy, which basically comprised a mercenary force. Some 20 different PSCs, employing 10,000 people, are working directly for the U.S. government, primarily for the Department of Defense and the Department of State, according to a Congressional Research Service report in 2008. The total direct cost to the U.S. government for acquiring security services in Iraq is not known. The U.S. Congressional Budget Office recently estimated that between 2003 and 2007, the U.S. government obligated between $3 billion and $4 billion to PSCs to acquire security services. Pay scale ranged as high as $1,500 a day, way beyond what our troops get. During that same 2003-2007 time frame, there were more than 300 reported cases of contracting mistakes. Not one employee got fired or denied promotion. In a stunning confession, the Pentagon itself acknowledged that $8.2 billion of taxpayer money flowed through contracts into Iraq, some in stacks or pallets of cash, without appropriate record-keeping or oversight. And these guys were also unaccountable in terms of what actions they took, including the killings of civilians. Iraq and Afghanistan are our first contractors' wars, but this is just part of an escalating trend that's outlined in Alison Stanger's book, One Nation Under Contract, for those who want to pursue the story further. Democrats and Republicans alike embraced outsourcing the work of government to the private sector whenever possible, she says. In 2000, the Defense Department spent $133.2 billion on contracts. By 2008, it was $391.9 billion, an almost threefold increase. State Department spending on contracting soared 431% from 2000 to 2008, while contracting at USAID grew a whopping 690%. Of course, contracting and paid mercenaries are what happen when the government wants to run its wars without the involvement of the citizens. When we had a draft, the gangs couldn't just get us into a war without some kind of sacrifice from the people of the country. The gangs like it better this way, using volunteers, mercenaries, and contractors, and never including the costs in the federal budget. Most Americans are pretty far removed from these wars we are waging, and so the gangs can do whatever they want without Americans protesting much. And the only politician who is speaking out against all this is Ron Paul, who is standing with integrity against both the Bloods and the Crips. Then there's the prison industry. Ever heard of the Corrections Corporation of America, CCA? They're our country's biggest operator of for-profit prisons, a trend that's been rapidly growing. As of the end of 2009, about 129,000 people in the U.S. were being held in privately managed correctional facilities. That's 16.4% of federal and 6.8% of state inmate populations. The CCA, which operates 66 of these places, has seen its revenues expand more than fivefold since the mid-1990s, since the first war on drugs, and now the business of locking up undocumented immigrants has blossomed. They and the GEO Group, its biggest competitor, generated more than $2.9 billion in 2010. What's in it for them? Long before this latest development, as of 2008, at least 37 states have legalized the contracting of prison labor by private corporations that mount their operations inside state prisons. The list of such companies contains the cream of U.S. corporate society: IBM, Boeing, Motorola, Microsoft, AT&T, Wireless, Texas Instruments, Dell, Compaq, Honeywell, Hewlett-Packard, Nortel, Lucent Technologies, 3Com, Intel, Northern Telecom, TWA, Nordstrom's, Revlon, Macy's, Pierre Cardin, Target Stores, and many more. Just between 1980 and 1994, profits went up from $392 million to $1.31 billion. The inmates in state pens do get paid, generally minimum wage. Thanks to prison labor, the United States is once again an attractive location for investment in work that was designed for third-world labor markets. A company that operated a maquiladora assembly plant in Mexico near the border closed down its operations there and relocated to San Quentin State Prison in California. In Texas, a factory fired its 150 workers and contracted the services of prisoner workers from the private Lockhart, Texas prison, where circuit boards are assembled for companies like IBM and Compaq. Now, we have a prison industrial complex right alongside our military industrial complex, all in pursuit of profits. And it's all intertwined with partners in politics. A 2011 report titled Gaming the System by the nonprofit DC group Justice Policy Institute describes how CCA had spent $17 million on federal lobbying efforts since 2000, along with doling out more than $1.2 million through their Political Action Committee to federal politicians. These same corporations have contributed over $7.2 million to state candidates and parties. Here's how the game works. After serving 18 years in the U.S. House of Representatives, Ohio's John Kasich retired in 2000 and took a managing director position in Ohio with Lehman Brothers. Lehman Brothers has a long-standing history with private prison companies, spending most of the late 1990s and 2000s before their collapse underwriting bonds for managing credit for both CCA and Cornell Corrections. After winning the governorship of Ohio in 2010, Kasich laid out his plans for privatizing state prison operations, along with appointing a former CCA employee to head the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Correction. Rounding out Kasich's connections to CCA is his close friend and former congressional chief of staff, whose lobbying firm was hired to represent CCA in January 2011. This past February, CCA sent letters out to 48 states offering to buy up their prisons to help out with challenging corrections budgets. All they're asking in return for that outlay of $250 million are a 20-year management contract and a guarantee that the prison will remain at least 90% of capacity. Harley Lappin, CCA's chief corrections officer and ex-director of the Federal Bureau of Prisons, wrote that he hoped the states will share our belief in the benefits of the purchase-and-manage model. Up until 2011, when Ohio peddled one of its biggest to CCA, the sale of a state prison to a private company had never happened. So, did you ever consider that one reason we're in these wars and keeping more people in prison is to feed the corporate maw and political trough? I think I'll take a ride down to my local post office while it still exists. Did you know the U.S. Postal Service, at age 236, is older than our Constitution? Not only the strongest union and second biggest employer after Walmart in our country, but our most venerable institution. But now a good number of both Bloods and Crips are telling us that it's broke. And so Saturday mail service and mail processing centers and lots of local post offices need to be shut down, and about 120,000 workers laid off. Want a clue as to the origin of the post office's financial crisis? It's not because of email, or FedEx, or UPS, for starters. Back in 2006, Congress passed something called the Postal Accountability Enhancement Act, which basically demanded that the agency give universal health care coverage to their current and future employees by paying $5.5 billion into the Treasury every year. No other entity in the country, public or private, ever had to do something like that. Does anybody else smell a conspiracy here? Universal health care coverage so somebody can privatize the post office? This is the ugly pass we've come to, folks. Stamp me ready for a revolution.